perfection. But how can I help it if I am bad? It would not have happened if I were not bad. So let me be what I am, but not pretend. Oh, what is Anna Pavlovna to me? Let them live as they like, and I will live as I like. I cannot be different. And it's all not the thing, not the thing.
But what is not the thing? Said Varenka, quite perplexed.
It's all not the thing. I can't live except by my own heart, but you live by principles.
I have loved you quite simply, but you, I expect, only in order to save me, to teach me.
You are unjust, said Varenka.
But I'm not talking about others, only about myself.
Kitty, came her mother's voice, come here and show Papa your corals. Kitty took from the table a little box which held the corals, and with a proud look, without having made it up with her friend, went to where her mother was.
"What's the matter? Why are you so red?" asked both her mother and father together.
"Nothing," she said. "I'll come back in a minute," and ran away.
"She's still here," thought Kitty. "What shall I say to her? Oh, dear. What have I done? What have I said? Why have I offended her? What am I to do? What shall I say to her?" thought Kitty, and stopped at the door.
Varenka, with her hat on, sat at the table examining the spring of her sunshade, which Kitty had broken. She looked up.
"Varenka, forgive me. Forgive me," whispered Kitty, coming close to her. "I don't remember what I said."
"Really, I did not wish to distress you," said Varenka, with a smile. Peace was made. But with her father's return, the world in which she had been living completely changed for Kitty. She did not renounce all she had learned, but realized that she had deceived herself when thinking that she could be what she wished to be. It was as if she had recovered consciousness. She felt the difficulty of remaining without hypocrisy or boastfulness on the level to which she had wished to rise. Moreover, she felt the oppressiveness of that world of sorrow, sickness, and death in which she was living. The effort she had been making to love it now seemed tormenting, and she longed to get away quickly to the fresh air, back to Russia, to Ergoshovo, where, as she knew from a letter, her sister Dolly had moved with the children. But her affection for Varenka was not weakened. When taking leave of her, Kitty tried to persuade her to come and stay with them in Russia.
"I will come when you are married," said Varenka.
"I shall never marry."
"Well, then, I shall never come."
"Then I will marry for that purpose only. Mind now, don't forget your promise," said Kitty. The doctor's prediction was justified. Kitty returned to Russia quite cured. She was not as careless and light-hearted as before, but she was at peace. Her old Moscow sorrows were no more than a memory. Part 3, Chapter 1.
Sergei Ivanich Koznishev, wishing to take a rest from mental work, went to stay with his brother in the country instead of going abroad as usual. According to his views, country life was preferable to any other, and he had now come to his brother's house to enjoy it. Konstantin Levin was very pleased, especially as he no longer expected his brother Nikolai to come that summer. But in spite of his affection and respect for Koznishev, Konstantin did not feel at ease with his stepbrother in the country. To Konstantin, the country was the place where one lived, that is to say, where one rejoiced, suffered, and laboured. But to Koznishev, the country was, on the one hand, a place of rest from work, and on the other, a useful antidote to depravity, an antidote to which he resorted with pleasure and with a consciousness of its utility. To Konstantin, the country seemed a good place because it was the scene of unquestionably useful labour. To Koznishev it seemed good because one could and should do nothing there. Besides this, Koznishev's attitude toward the peasants jarred on Konstantin. Koznishev was wont to say that he knew and loved the common people. He often conversed with peasants and was able to do it well, frankly and without affectation, deducing from every such conversation data in the peasant's favour and proofs of his own knowledge of the people. Constantine regarded the peasants as the chief partners in a common undertaking, and despite his respect and the feeling of a blood tie, probably, as he said, sucked in with the milk of his peasant nurse, he, as partner in their common undertaking, though often filled with admiration for the strength, meekness, and justice of these people, was very often, when the business required other qualities, exasperated with them for their carelessness, untidiness, drunkenness, and untruthfulness. Had Constantine been asked whether he liked the peasants, he would not have known what to answer. He both liked and disliked them, just as he liked and disliked all human beings. With his natural kind heart, he of course liked human beings more than he disliked them, and naturally the peasants were included. But he could not like or dislike the people as if they were something apart, because he not only lived among them, his interests closely bound up with theirs, but he considered himself one of the people and could not find in himself any special qualities or defects which placed him in contrast with them. Moreover, though he had lived in very close relations with the peasants as their master, mediator, and above all as their adviser, the peasants trusted him and would often come 30 miles to consult him, he had no definite opinion concerning them. Had he been asked whether he knew the people, he would have been just as much at a loss for a reply as he was for a reply to the question whether he liked them. To say that he knew the peasants was tantamount to saying that he knew human beings. He continually observed and learnt to know all sorts of human beings, among them human beings of the peasant class, whom he considered interesting, constantly discovering in them new traits and altering his opinions accordingly. Koznishev, on the other hand, just as he praised country life as a contrast to the life he disliked, liked the peasants as a contrast to the class he disliked, and regarded them as a contrast to humanity in general. His methodical mind had formed definite views on the life of the people, founded partly on that life itself, but chiefly on its contrast. He never altered his opinions about the people, nor his sympathetic attitude toward them. In the disputes which took place between the brothers when discussing the peasants, Koznishev was always victorious, just because he had definite views about them, their character, attributes, and tastes, while Constantine had no definite and fixed views, and was often guilty of self-contradiction when arguing on that subject. Koznishev thought his younger brother a splendid fellow, with his heart in the right place, but with a mind which, though rather quick, was swayed by the impression of the moment, and was therefore full of contradictions. With an elder brother's condescension, he sometimes explained to him the meaning of things, but could find no pleasure in discussion because he could gain too easy a victory. Constantine considered his brother to be a man of great intellect, noble in the highest sense of the word, and gifted with the power of working for the general welfare. But the older he grew and the more intimately he came to know his brother, the oftener the thought occurred to him that the power of working for the general welfare, a power of which he felt himself entirely destitute, was not a virtue, but rather a lack of something, not a lack of kindly honesty and noble desires and tastes, but a lack of the power of living, of what is called heart, the aspiration which makes a man choose one out of all the innumerable paths of life that present themselves and desire that alone. The better he knew his brother, the more he noticed that Koznishev and many other social workers were not led to this love for the common good by their hearts, but because they had reasoned out in their minds that it was a good thing to do that kind of work and took to it accordingly. What further strengthened this conviction was noticing that his brother did not take the question of the general welfare or of the immortality of the soul any more to heart than a game of chess. Another thing which made Konstantin Levin feel his brother's presence inconvenient was that in the country, especially during the summer, while Levin was always busy with the farm and the long summer days were too short for doing all that had to be done, Koznishev was resting. But even though he was resting from mental labours and was not writing,
He was so used to mental activity that he liked expressing his thoughts in an elegant, concise style and liked having a listener. His most usual and natural listener was his brother, and therefore, despite their friendly relations, Constantine felt uncomfortable at leaving him alone. Koznishev loved to lie basking in the sunshine, talking lazily.
"You can't imagine what a pleasure this complete laziness is to me. Not a thought in my brain. You might send a ball rolling through it."
But it wearied Constantine to sit listening to him, particularly because he knew that during his absence the manure was being carted into the field, and it was impossible to guess where they would throw it if he were not there to see. The ploughshares, too, would not be screwed up properly or taken out, and then he would be told that these ploughs were a silly invention. "How can they be compared to our old Russian plough?" and so on.
"Haven't you walked about enough in this heat?" said Koznishev.
"No, I must just look in at the counting-house for a moment," answered Levin, and off he ran to the fields.
Chapter 2. At the beginning of June, Levin's old nurse and housekeeper, Agafya Mikhailovna, happened to slip as she was carrying to the cellar a jar of mushrooms which she had just pickled, and sprained her wrist. A talkative young medical man who had only just qualified and been appointed doctor for the Zemstvo district arrived, examined the hand, said it was not sprained, and enjoyed a talk with the celebrated Sergei Ivanovich Koznishev. He told him all the gossip of the district to show off his enlightened views and complained of the unsatisfactory conditions prevailing there. Koznishev listened attentively, asked questions, and, enlivened by the presence of a new listener, became quite chatty, made some pointed and weighty remarks respectfully appreciated by the young doctor, and reached that state of animation his brother so well knew, which generally followed a brilliant and lively conversation. After the doctor's departure, Koznishev felt inclined to go to the river with his fishing rod. He was fond of angling, and seemed proud of being able to like such a stupid occupation. Constantine, who was obliged to go to the cornfields and meadows, offered to give his brother a lift in his trap. It was just the time of year, the turning point of summer, when the result of that year's harvest becomes assured, when the autumn sowings have to be considered, and when the hay harvest is close at hand, when the grey-green rye waves its formed but as yet not swollen ears lightly in the wind, when the green oats, with irregular clumps of yellow grass interspersed, stand unevenly on late-sown fields, when the early buckwheat spreads out and hides the ground, when the fallow land, trodden as hard as a stone by the cattle, is half ploughed, with here and there long strips omitted as too hard for the plough, when the smell of dried heaps of manure in the fields mingles with the honeyed perfume of the grasses, and waiting for the scythe, the lowland meadows lie smooth as a lake by the river's banks, showing here and there black heaps of weeded sorrel stalks. It was the time of that short pause before the labour, yearly renewed, of getting in the harvest, which always demands all the peasant's strength for its accomplishment. The promise of the harvest was splendid, the weather clear and hot, and the short night dewy. The brothers had to pass through the forest on their way to the meadows. Koznishev was all the while filled with admiration for the beauty of the thickly leaved forest, and kept pointing out to his brother the old lime trees, looking so dark on the shady side, covered with creamy buds all ready to burst into blossom, or the new shoots, sparkling like emeralds on the trees. Konstantin Levin did not like talking or hearing about the beauty of nature. Words seemed to detract from the beauty of what he was looking at. He assented to what his brother said, but could not help thinking of other things. When they emerged from the forest, his attention was arrested at the sight of a fallow field and a hillock, here and there yellow with grass or broken up and cut into squares, in some parts speckled with heaps of manure or even ploughed. A string of carts was moving over the field.
Levin counted the carts and was pleased to see that sufficient manure was being brought. At the sight of the meadows, his thoughts turned to the hay harvest. The thought of the hay harvest always touched him to the quick. When they reached the meadow, Levin stopped. At the roots of the thick grass, the morning dew still lingered, and Koznishev, afraid of wetting his feet, asked his brother to drive him across the meadow to the willow clump near which perch could be caught. Though Konstantin was loath to crush his grass, he drove across the meadow. The tall grass twined softly about the wheels and the horse's legs, leaving seeds on the wet spokes and hubs. Koznishev sat down by the willows, while Levin led away his horse, and having tethered it, stepped into the immense grey-green sea of grass, so dense that the wind could not ruffle it. In the meadow, which was flooded every spring, the silky grass, now scattering seeds, reached almost to his waist. When Konstantin Levin had passed right across the meadow and reached the road, he met an old man with a swollen eye carrying a swarm of bees in a skep.
"Have you found it, Famich?"
he asked.
"Found it indeed, Konstantin Dmitrich. I only hope not to lose my own. This is the second time a swarm has got away, and it's only thanks to those lads there that I've got this one back. They were ploughing for you, and unharnessed a horse and galloped after it. Well, Famich, what do you think? Shall we begin mowing, or wait a little?" "Oh, well, our custom is to wait till St. Peter's Day, but you always mow earlier." "Why not, God willing? The grass is fine. There'll be more room for the cattle."
"And what do you think of the weather?"
"That's God's business. Perhaps the weather will keep fine, too."
Levin went back to his brother. Though he had caught nothing, Koznishev did not feel bored and seemed in the best of spirits. Levin saw that he had been roused by his conversation with the doctor and wanted to have a talk. Levin, on the contrary, was impatient to get home in order to give orders about hiring the mowers on the morrow and to decide about the hay harvest, which greatly occupied his mind.
"Well, let's go," said he.
"Where's the hurry? Let's sit here a little. How wet you are. Though nothing bites, it's pleasant. Hunting and similar sports are good because they bring one in touch with nature. How lovely this steel-coloured water is," said he. "And these grassy banks always remind me of that riddle. You know, the grass says to the water, 'We will shake, we will shake.'"
"I don't know that riddle," replied Levin, in a dull tone.
Chapter 3
"Do you know, I've been thinking about you," said Koznishev. "From what the doctor told me, and he's by no means a stupid young fellow, the things going on in your district are simply disgraceful. I've already told you, and I say it again, it is not right to stop away from the Zemstvo meetings, and in general to take no part in its activities. If all the better sort stand aside, of course, heaven only knows what will happen. We expend money for salaries, but there are no schools, no medical assistance, no midwives, no chemists, no anything."
"You know I have tried," Levin replied slowly and reluctantly, "but I can't."
"So what am I to do?" "Why can't you? I confess I don't understand. I can't admit it to be indifference or inaptitude.
Is it possible that it is mere laziness?"
"Neither the one nor the other, nor the last. I have tried and seen that I can do nothing," said Levin.
He did not pay much attention to what his brother was saying. Peering into the distance across the river, he made out something black in the cornfield and could not see whether it was only a horse or the steward on horseback.
"Why can you do nothing? You have made an attempt, and because, according to your judgment, it was a failure, you gave it up. Fancy having so little ambition."
"Ambition," reiterated Levin, stung by his brother's words. "I do not understand it. If at college they had told me that others understood the integral calculus and I did not, that would have been a case for ambition. But in these matters, the first requisite is a conviction that one has the necessary ability, and above all, that it is all very important."
"Well, is it not very important?" said Koznishev,
stirred by the perception that his occupations were regarded as unimportant, and especially by his brother's evident inattention to what he was saying. "They don't appear important to me. Do what you will, they don't grip me," replied Lievin, having made out that what he saw was the steward, who was probably dismissing the peasants from their ploughing too soon, for they were turning the ploughs over.
"Is it possible they have finished ploughing?" thought he.
"Come now, after all," continued the elder brother, with a frown on his handsome, intelligent face, "there are limits to everything. It is all very well to be a crank, to be sincere, and dislike hypocrisy. I know that very well. But what you are saying has either no meaning at all, or a very bad meaning. How can you consider it unimportant that the people, whom you love, as you maintain—" "I never maintained it," thought Lievin, "are dying without help. Ignorant midwives murder the babies, and the people remain steeped in ignorance at the mercy of every village clerk, while you have in your power the means of helping them, and yet you are not helping because you do not consider it important." And Koznishev confronted his brother with this dilemma. Either you are so undeveloped that you don't see all that you might do, or you don't want to sacrifice your peace of mind, or your vanity, I don't know which, in order to do it. Constantine felt that there was nothing for him but to submit, or else to own to a lack of love for the common cause, and he felt wounded and grieved. "Both the one and the other," said he resolutely. "I can't see how it is to be done."
"What? Don't see how medical help can be given by distributing the money in a proper way?"
"Well, it seems impossible to me. To give medical help over the whole 3,000 square miles of our district, with our deep snow, impassable when it begins melting, our snow drifts, and the pressure of work at harvest time, is impossible. Besides, I have no faith in medicine generally."
"Oh, come now, that is unjust. I could cite thousands of cases to you. And how about schools?"
"Schools? What for?"
"What do you mean? Is it possible to doubt the utility of education? If it is good for you, why not for everybody?"
Constantine felt himself morally cornered, and in consequence became excited and involuntarily betrayed the chief cause of his indifference to social questions.
"All this may be very good, but why should I trouble about medical centres which I should never use, or schools to which I should never send my children, and to which the peasants would not wish to send theirs either, and to which I am not fully convinced they ought to send them?" said he.
This unexpected view of the question took Koznishev by surprise, but he immediately formed a new plan of attack. He remained silent a while, lifted his rod and threw the line again, and then turned to his brother with a smile.
"Now, let's see. There is need of a medical centre, after all. Did we not send for the district doctor, for Agafya Mikhailovna? But I think her hand will remain crooked all the same."
"Well, that's very questionable. And then a peasant who can read and write is more useful to you, and worth more."
"Oh, no. Ask anyone you like," said Constantine decidedly. "A peasant who can read and write is far worse as a labourer. They can't mend the roads, and when they build a bridge, they steal."
"However, all that is not to the point," said Koznishev, frowning. He did not like to be contradicted, especially when he was met with arguments that incessantly shifted their ground, introducing new considerations without sequence, so that it was difficult to know which of them to answer first.
"Wait a bit. Do you admit that education is a good thing for the people?"
"I do,"
replied Lievin unguardedly, and at once realized that he had not said what he really thought. He felt that, since he admitted this much, it would be proved to him that he was talking meaningless twaddle. How it would be proved to him he did not know, but he knew that it certainly would be proved, logically, and waited for that proof. The proof turned out to be far simpler than Constantine anticipated.
"If you admit it to be good," said Koznishev, "then, as an honest man, you cannot help loving and sympathizing with such movements and wishing to work for them."
"But I am not yet prepared to say that such work is desirable," returned Lievin.
"What?
Why, you said just now, I mean I consider it neither desirable nor possible.
You can't tell without having tried it.
Well, let's grant it is so, said Levin, though he did not grant it at all. Still, I don't see why I should be bothered with it.
What do you mean?
No. Oh, since we have started on the topic, perhaps you'd better explain it to me from a philosophical point of view, said Levin.
I don't see what philosophy has to do with it, replied Koznishev, in a tone that made it seem, at least Levin thought so, that he did not consider his brother had a right to argue on philosophical questions. This irritated Levin.
This is what it has to do with it, he said, getting heated. I believe that in any case the motive power of all our actions is our personal happiness. At present, I, a nobleman, see nothing in our Zemstvo that could conduce to my welfare. The roads are not better and cannot be made better, and my horses do manage to pull me over the bad ones. I don't require doctors and medical centres. I don't need the magistrate. I never apply to him and never will. I not only do not require schools, but they would even do me harm, as I have already told you. To me, the Zemstvo means nothing but a tax of 2 kopecks per desiatina, my having to go to the town, sharing a bed with bugs, and listening to all sorts of nonsense and nastiness, and my personal interests do not prompt me to do it.
Come, smilingly interrupted Koznishev. It was not our personal interest which induced us to work for the emancipation of the serfs, and yet we did it.
No, no, Konstantin interrupted, growing more and more heated. The emancipation of the serfs was quite a different matter. There was a personal interest in that. We wanted to throw off a yoke that was oppressing us all good men. But to be a member of the council to discuss how many scavengers are required and how the drains should be laid in a town in which I am not living, to be on the jury and try a peasant who's stolen a horse, to sit for 6 hours on end listening to all sorts of rubbish jabbered by the council and prosecutor, and to the president asking our idiot Alyoshka, prisoner at the bar, do you plead guilty to the indictment of having stolen a horse?
Konstantin Levin was being carried away and was personating the judge and the idiot Alyoshka. It seemed to him that all this was relevant to the case in point. But Koznishev shrugged his shoulders.
Well, what do you want to prove by that?
I only want to prove that I will always stand up with all my power for the rights which touch me and my personal interests. When they searched us students and gendarmes read our letters, I was ready to defend with all my power my right to education and liberty. I understand conscription, which touches the fate of my children, of my brothers and myself, and I'm ready to discuss what concerns me. But how to dispose of 40,000 rubles of Zemstvo money, or how to try the idiot Alyoshka, I neither understand nor can take part in.
Konstantin Levin spoke as if the dam of his flood of words had been broken. Koznishev smiled. And tomorrow you may be going to law. Would you rather be tried in the old criminal court?
I won't go to law. I'm not going to cut anybody's throat, so I shall never be in need of that sort of thing. All those Zemstvo institutions of ours, he said, again jumping off to a subject that had no bearing on the case in point, are like those little birches that are cut down for decorations at Whitsuntide, and we Russians stick them up to imitate the woods that have grown up naturally in Western Europe. I cannot water these birches or believe in them from my soul.
Koznishev only shrugged his shoulders to express his wonder at this sudden introduction of little birches into their discussion, though he had at once grasped his brother's meaning.
Wait a moment. One can't reason that way, you know, he remarked.
But Konstantin, wishing to justify the failing of which he was aware in himself, his indifference to the general welfare, continued,
I think that no activity can endure if it is not based on personal interest. That is the common and philosophical truth, said he, emphasizing the word philosophical, as if he wanted to show that he might talk about philosophy as much as anyone else.
Koznishev smiled again.
He too has some philosophy or other to serve his inclinations, he thought.
You'd better leave philosophy alone, said he.
The principal task of philosophy has always, in all ages, been to find the necessary connection existing between personal and general interests. But that is not the point. I need only correct your illustration to get at the point. The birches are not stuck in. Some of them are planted, and others are sown and have to be tended carefully. Only those peoples have a future. Only those peoples can be called historic that have a sense of what is important and great in their institutions and value them. And to prove the inaccuracy of Levin's views, Koznishev carried the conversation into the realm of philosophy and history, which was beyond Konstantin's reach. As to your not liking it, pardon me, but that only comes of our Russian laziness and seigneurial habits, and I am sure that in your case it is a temporary error and will pass. Konstantin was silent. He felt himself beaten at every point, yet was sure that his brother had not understood what he had been trying to say, only he did not know why this was so, whether it was because he could not express himself clearly, or because his brother either could not or did not wish to understand him. But he did not go deeply into these questions, and without replying to his brother, began reflecting on a totally different and personal matter. Koznishev wound up his last line, untied the horse, and they started on their homeward way. Chapter 4. The personal matter that occupied Levin while he was talking with his brother was this. The year before, when visiting a field that was being mown, he had lost his temper with his steward, and to calm himself had used a remedy of his own. He took a scythe from one of the peasants and himself began mowing. He liked this work so much that he went mowing several times. He mowed all the meadow in front of his house, and when spring came, he planned to devote several whole days to mowing with the peasants. Since his brother's arrival, however, he was in doubt whether to go mowing or not. He did not feel comfortable at the thought of leaving his brother alone all day long, and he also feared that Koznishev might laugh at him. But while walking over the meadow, he recalled the impression mowing had made on him, and almost made up his mind to do it. After his irritating conversation with his brother, he again remembered his intention. "I need physical exercise. Without it, my character gets quite spoiled," thought he, and determined to go and mow, however uncomfortable his brother and the peasants might make him feel. In the evening, Konstantin went to the office and gave orders about the work, sending round to the villages to tell the mowers to come next day to the Kalina meadow, the largest and finest he had. "And please send my scythe to Titus to be sharpened and have it taken to the meadow tomorrow. I may go mowing myself," he said, trying to overcome his confusion. The steward smiled and said, "All right, sir." That evening at tea, Levin said to his brother, "The weather looks settled. Tomorrow we begin mowing." "I like that work very much," said Koznishev. "I like it awfully, too. I have mown with the peasants now and then, and tomorrow I want to mow all day." Koznishev looked up at his brother in surprise. "How do you mean? All day? Just like the peasants?" "Yes, it is very pleasant," replied Levin. "It is splendid physical exercise, but you'll hardly be able to hold out," remarked Koznishev, without the least sarcasm. "I've tried it. At first it seems hard, but one gets drawn into it. I don't think I shall lag behind." "Dear me! But tell me, how do the peasants take it? I expect they laugh at their crank of a master." "No, I don't think so. But it is such pleasant work, and at the same time so hard, that one has no time for thinking." "But how can you dine with them? It would not be quite the thing to send you claret and roast turkey out there." "No, I'll just come home at their dinner time." Next morning, Konstantin got up earlier than usual, but giving instructions about the farming delayed him, and when he came to the meadow, each man was already mowing his second swathe. From the hill, as he came to his first swathe, he could see, in the shade at his feet, a part of the meadow that was already mown, with the green heaps of grass and dark piles of coats thrown down by the mowers. As he drew nearer, the peasants,
following each other in a long, straggling line, some with coats on, some in their shirts, each swinging his scythe in his own manner, gradually came into sight. He counted 42 of them. They moved slowly along the uneven bottom of the meadow where a weir had once been. Lievin recognized some of his own men. Old Ermil, wearing a very long white shirt, was swinging his scythe with his back bent. Young Vaska, who had been in Lievin's service as coachman, and who at each swing of his scythe cut the grass the whole width of his swathe. And Titus, Lievin's mowing master, a thin little peasant who went along without stopping, mowing his wide swathe as if in play. Lievin dismounted, and, tethering his horse by the roadside, went up to Titus, who fetched another scythe from behind a bush, and gave it to Lievin.
"It's ready, master. Like a razor, it'll mow of itself,"
said Titus, taking off his cap and smiling as he handed the scythe. Lievin took it and began to put himself in position. The peasants, perspiring and merry, who had finished their swathes, came out onto the road one after another, and laughingly exchanged greetings with their master. They all looked at him, but no one made any remark until a tall old man with a shrivelled, beardless face, wearing a sheepskin jacket, stepped out onto the road and addressed him.
"Mind, master, having put your hand to the plough, don't look back."
And Lievin heard the sound of repressed laughter among the mowers.
"I will try not to lag behind," he said, taking his place behind Titus and waiting his turn to fall in. "Mind," repeated the old man.
Titus made room for Lievin, and Lievin followed him. By the roadside, the grass was short and tough, and Lievin, who had not done any mowing for a long time and was confused by so many eyes upon him, mowed badly for the first 10 minutes, though he swung his scythe with much vigour. He heard voices behind him.
"It's not properly adjusted. The grip is not right. See how he has to stoop," said one. "Hold the heel lower," said another. "Never mind, it's all right. You'll get into it," said the old man. "There he goes. You're taking too wide a swathe. You'll get knocked up. He's the master. He must work. He's working for himself. But look how uneven. That's what the likes of us used to get a thump on the back for."
They came to softer grass, and Lievin, who was listening without replying, followed Titus and tried to mow as well as possible. When they had gone some 100 steps, Titus was still going on without pausing, showing no signs of fatigue, while Lievin was already beginning to fear he would not be able to keep up, he felt so tired. He swung his scythe, feeling almost at the last gasp, and made up his mind to ask Titus to stop. But just at that moment Titus stopped of his own accord, stooped, took up some grass, and wiped his scythe with it. Lievin straightened himself, sighed, and looked back. The peasant behind him was still mowing, but was obviously tired too, for he stopped without coming even with Lievin and began whetting his scythe. Titus whetted his own and Lievin's, and they began mowing again. The same thing happened at Lievin's second attempt. Titus swung his scythe, swing after swing, without stopping and without getting tired. Lievin followed, trying not to lag behind, but it became harder and harder, until at last the moment came when he felt he had no strength left, and then Titus again stopped and began whetting his scythe. In this way they finished the swathes. They were long, and to Lievin seemed particularly difficult. But when it was done, and Titus, with his scythe over his shoulder, turned about and slowly retraced his steps, placing his feet on the marks left on the mown surface by the heels of his boots, and Lievin went down his own swathe in the same way, then, in spite of the perspiration that ran down his face in streams and dripped from his nose, and though his back was as wet as if the shirt had been soaked in water, he felt very light-hearted. What gave him most pleasure was the knowledge that he would be able to keep up with the peasants. The only thing marring his joy was the fact that his swathe was not well mown. "I must swing the scythe less with my arms and more with the whole of my body," he thought, comparing Titus's swathe, cut straight as if by measure with his own, on which the grass lay scattered and uneven.
As Lievin was aware, Titus had been mowing this swathe with special rapidity, probably to put his master to the test, and it chanced to be a very long one. The next swathes were easier, but still Lievin had to work with all his might to keep even with the peasants. He thought of nothing and desired nothing except not to lag behind and to do his work as well as possible. He heard only the swishing of the scythes and saw only the receding figure of Titus, the convex half-circle of the mown piece before him, and the grasses and heads of flowers falling in waves about the blade of his scythe, and in the background, the end of the swathe where he would rest. Suddenly he was conscious of a pleasant coolness on his hot, perspiring shoulders, without knowing what it was or whence it came. He glanced up at the sky whilst whetting his scythe. A dark cloud was hanging low overhead, and large drops of rain were falling. Some of the peasants went to put on their coats. Others, as well as Lievin, felt pleasure in the refreshing rain and merely moved their shoulders up and down. They came to the end of another swathe. They went on mowing long and short rows, good and poor grass. Lievin had lost count of time and had really no idea whether it was late or early. His work was undergoing a change which gave him intense pleasure. While working, he sometimes forgot for some minutes what he was about and felt quite at ease. Then his mowing was nearly as even as that of Titus. But as soon as he began thinking about it and trying to work better, he at once felt how hard the task was and mowed badly. He finished a swathe and was about to start another when Titus paused and went up to the old man, and both looked at the sun.
"What are they talking about? And why don't they start another swathe?" thought Lievin.
It did not occur to him that the peasants who had been mowing unceasingly for 4 hours wanted their breakfast.
"Breakfast time, master," said the old man.
"Is it time?
Well then, breakfast."
Lievin handed his scythe to Titus, and with the peasants who were going to fetch the bread that lay with their coats, went across the swathes of the long mown portion of the meadow, slightly sprinkled with rain. Only then he remembered that he had not been right about the weather, and that the rain was wetting the hay.
"The hay will be spoiled," said he. "Won't hurt, master. Mow in the rain, rake when it's fine."
Lievin untied his horse and rode home to his coffee. By the time Lievin had finished breakfast, Koznishev had only just got up, and Lievin went back to the meadow before Koznishev had come to table. Chapter 5. After breakfast, Lievin got placed between a humorous old man who invited him to be his neighbour and a young peasant who had only got married last autumn and was now out for his first summer's mowing. The old man went along holding himself erect, moving with regular, long steps, turning out his toes, and with a precise and even motion that seemed to cost him no more effort than swinging his arms when walking, he laid the grass in a level, high ridge, as if in play, or as if the sharp scythe of its own accord whizzed through the juicy grass. Young Mishka went behind Lievin. His pleasant young face, with a wisp of grass tied round the forehead over his hair, worked all over with the effort. But whenever anyone glanced at him, he smiled. Evidently he would have died rather than confess that the work was trying. Between these two went Lievin. Now, in the hottest part of the day, the work did not seem so hard to him. The perspiration in which he was bathed was cooling, and the sun, which burnt his back, his head and his arm, bare to the elbow, added to his strength and perseverance in his task, and those unconscious intervals when it became possible not to think of what he was doing recurred more and more often. The scythe seemed to mow of itself. Those were happy moments. Yet more joyous were the moments when, reaching the river at the lower end of the swathes, the old man would wipe his scythe with the wet grass, rinse its blade in the clear water, and dipping his whetstone box in the stream, would offer it to Lievin.
"A little of my kvass? It's good," said he, with a wink.
And really, Levin thought he had never tasted any nicer drink than this lukewarm water with green stuff floating in it and a flavour of the rusty tin box. And then came the ecstasy of a slow walk, one hand resting on the scythe, when there was leisure to wipe away the streams of perspiration, to breathe deep, to watch the line of mowers, and to see what was going on around in forest and field. The longer Levin went on mowing, the oftener he experienced those moments of oblivion when his arms no longer seemed to swing the scythe, but the scythe itself, his whole body, so conscious and full of life. And as if by magic, regularly and definitely, without a thought being given to it, the work accomplished itself of its own accord. These were blessed moments. It was trying only when thought became necessary in order to mow around a molehill or a space where the hard sorrel stalks had not been weeded out. The old man accomplished this with ease. When he came to a molehill, he would change his action, and with a short jerk of the point and then of the heel of his scythe, he would mow all round the molehill. And while doing this, he noted everything he came to. Now he plucked a sorrel stalk and ate it, or offered it to Levin. Now he threw aside a branch with the point of his scythe, or examined a quail's nest from which the hen bird had flown up, almost under the scythe. Or he caught a beetle, lifting it with the scythe point as with a fork, and after showing it to Levin, threw it away. Levin and the young fellow on the other side of him found such changes of action difficult. Both of them, having got into one strained kind of movement, were in the grip of feverish labour and had not the power to change the motion of their bodies and at the same time to observe what lay before them. Levin did not notice how time passed. Had he been asked how long he had been mowing, he would have answered half an hour, although it was nearly noon. As they were about to begin another swathe, the old man drew Levin's attention to the little boys and girls approaching from all sides along the road and through the long grass, hardly visible above it, carrying jugs of kvass stoppered with rags and bundles of bread which strained their little arms.
"Look at the midges crawling along,"
he said, pointing to the children and glancing at the sun from under his lifted hand. They completed two more swathes, and then the old man stopped.
"Come, master, it's dinner time,"
said he with decision. All the mowers, on reaching the river, went across the swathes to where their coats lay, and where the children who had brought their dinners sat waiting for them. The men who had driven from a distance gathered in the shadow of their carts. Those who lived nearer sheltered under the willow growth on which they hung grass. Levin sat down beside them. He did not want to go away. All the peasants' restraint in the presence of the master had vanished. The men began preparing for dinner. Some had a wash. The young lads bathed in the river. Others arranged places for their after-dinner rest, unfastened their bags of bread, and unstoppered their jugs of kvass. The old man broke some rye bread into a bowl, mashed it with a spoon handle, poured over it some water from his tin, broke more bread into it and salted it, and then, turning to the east, said grace.
"Come, master, have some of my dinner,"
said he, kneeling in front of his bowl. The bread and water was so nice that Levin gave up all intention of going home to lunch. He shared the old man's meal and got into conversation with him about his domestic affairs, taking a lively interest in them and telling him about his own, giving him all the particulars which would interest the old peasant. When the old man got up and, having said grace, lay down beneath the willows with an armful of grass under his head, Levin did the same, regardless of the flies, importunate and persistent in the sunshine, and of the crawling insects that tickled his perspiring face and body. He at once fell asleep, waking only when the sun touched the opposite side of the willows and reached him. The old man had already been long awake and sat setting the scythes for the young men. Levin looked round and hardly recognized the place. Everything was so altered. A wide expanse of the meadow was already mown, and with its swathes of grass already giving off perfume, shone with a peculiar, fresh brilliance in the oblique rays of the descending sun. The bushes by the river where the grass had been cut, and the river itself, with its curves, previously invisible, were now glittering like steel, and the people getting up and moving about, the steep wall of yet uncut grass, and the hawks soaring over the bare meadow, struck him as something quite new. When he was fully awake, Lievin began to calculate how much had been done and how much could still be done that day. An extraordinary amount had been done by the 42 men. The larger meadow, which in the days of serfdom had taken 30 men 2 days to mow, was all finished except some short patches at the corners. But Lievin wanted to get as much as possible done that day, and it was vexatious to see the sun already declining. He was not feeling at all tired, and was only longing to work again and to accomplish as much as he could.
"What do you think? Could we manage to get Mushkin Heights mown today?" he asked the old man.
"Well, God willing, we might. The sun is not very high, though. Perhaps. If the lads could have a little vodka."
At half-time, when they sat down again and those who smoked were lighting their pipes, the old man informed the young fellows that if they mowed the Mushkin Heights, there would be vodka.
"What? Not mow that? Come along, Titus, we'll get it clear in no time." "You can eat your fill at night. Let's begin," shouted different voices,
and the mowers took their places, finishing their bread as they went.
"Now then, lads, keep going,"
said Titus, starting off ahead almost at a trot.
"Go on, go on,"
said the old man, hurrying after him and easily catching him up.
"Take care, I'll mow you down."
And young and old vied with each other at mowing. But in spite of their haste, they did not spoil the grass, and the swathes fell just as evenly and exactly as before. The small patch that was left in the last corner was mown in 5 minutes, and whilst the last mowers were finishing their swathes, those in front, carrying their coats over their shoulders, were already crossing the road toward Mushkin Heights. The sun was already setting toward the trees when, with their tin boxes rattling, they entered the wooded ravine of the heights. The grass that in the middle of the ravine reached to their waists was delicate, soft, and broad-bladed, speckled here and there with cow wheat. After a short consultation as to whether they should mow the ravine across or lengthwise, Prokhor, a gigantic dark man and a famous mower, took the lead. He went in front, mowed a swathe, turned round and restarted. Following him, all the others took their places, going downhill along the creek and back up to the very skirts of the wood. The sun had set behind the wood, and now shone only on the mowers at the top of the hill, while in the valley, where the mists were rising, they were in cool, dewy shade. The work proceeded briskly. The scented grass, cut down with a sound that showed how juicy it was, fell in high ridges. On the short swathes, the mowers crowded together, their tin boxes clattering, their scythes ringing whenever they touched, the whetstones whistling upon the blades, and their merry voices resounding as they urged each other on. Lievin was again mowing between the old man and the lad. The old man, who had put on his sheepskin jacket, was still as jolly, witty, and easy in his movements as before. In the wood, their scythes continually cut down wood mushrooms grown plump amid the juicy grass. The old man stooped each time he came upon one, picked it up, and put it inside his jacket, saying,
"Another treat for my old woman."
It was easy to cut the wet, soft grass, but on the other hand it was very difficult to go up and down the steep slopes of the ravine. This, however, did not trouble the old man. Swinging his scythe just as usual, taking short steps with feet shod in large bark-plaited shoes, he slowly climbed the slopes, and though his whole body and his loosely hanging trousers shook, he did not miss a single mushroom or a curious grass, and continued joking with the other peasants and with Lievin. Lievin followed, and often thought he would certainly fall when climbing a mound with his scythe in his hand, a mound so steep that it would have been hard to climb even unencumbered. Still, he managed to climb it and to do all that had to be done, and he felt as if some external force were urging him on. Chapter 6 Mushkin Heights were mown, and the peasants, having completed their last swathes, put on their coats and went home in high spirits. Levin, having regretfully taken leave of them, mounted and rode home. He looked back from the top of the hill. He could not see the men, for the mist rising from the hollow hid them, but he heard their merry, rough voices, laughter, and the clanking of the scythes. Koznishev had long had his dinner, and was in his room drinking iced water with lemon while looking over the papers and magazines just arrived by post, when Levin rushed in, his tangled hair clinging to his moist brow, his shirt saturated back and front and dark with perspiration, and cried out joyfully,
"We have finished the whole of the meadow! How delightful it is! And how have you got on?"
Levin had quite forgotten the unpleasant conversation of the previous day.
"Dear me, what a sight you are,"
said Koznishev, turning to his brother with a momentary look of vexation.
"The door! The door! Shut it!" he exclaimed. "You've certainly let in a whole dozen!"
Koznishev could not bear flies, and opened the windows in his room only at night, keeping the door carefully closed.
"No, not one, I swear, and if I have, I'll catch it. You would not believe what enjoyment it was. And how have you spent the day?"
"Quite well. But have you really been mowing all day? You must be as hungry as a wolf. Kutzma has everything ready for you."
"No, I don't want to eat. I've had something there, but I'll go and wash."
"Yes, yes, go, and I will come presently."
Koznishev shook his head as he looked at his brother.
"Go.
Go and be quick," he added with a smile, as, gathering together his books, he prepared to go too. He also felt suddenly quite cheerful and did not wish to part from his brother.
"And where were you when it rained?"
"What rain was that?" "Only a few drops." "Well, then, I'll come back directly. So you spent the day all right?" "That's good."
And Levin went off to dress. 5 minutes later, the brothers met again in the dining room. Though Levin had imagined that he was not hungry and sat down to table only not to offend Kutzma, yet when he began eating, he thought everything delicious. Koznishev smiled as he looked at him.
"Oh, yes, there's a letter for you," said he. "Kutzma, please bring it. It's downstairs. And mind you shut the door."
The letter was from Oblonsky. Levin read it aloud. Oblonsky wrote from Petersburg, "I have had a letter from Dolly. She is in Ergushevo, and everything is out of gear there. Please go and see her and help her with your advice. You know all about everything. She's quite alone, poor thing. My mother-in-law is still abroad."
"That's splendid. I will certainly go and see her," said Levin. "Or shall we both go? She's such a good woman. Don't you think so?"
"Is it far from here?"
"A little over 25 miles, or maybe even 30, but the road is excellent. We'll have a fine drive."
"I shall be very glad," replied Koznishev, still smiling.
The sight of his younger brother had a distinctly cheering influence on him.
"I must say you have an appetite," he said, glancing at the sunburnt, ruddy face bent over the plate. "Fine. You would hardly believe what a remedy it is for every kind of folly. I'm thinking of enriching medicine with a new word, Arbeitskur."
"You would hardly require it, I should say."
"No, but those who suffer from their nerves do."
"Yes, it ought to be tested. You know, I thought of coming to the meadow to have a look at you, but it was so unbearably hot that I got only as far as the forest. I sat there a little and then went through the forest to the village where I met your old wet nurse and sounded her as to what the peasants think of you. From her I understand that they do not approve of your doing it. She said, it's not gentlefolk's work. It seems to me that on the whole, in the people's opinion, a very decided demand for what they call gentlefolk's work exists, and they don't approve of the gentry going outside the bounds they set for them." "Possibly. But it is a pleasure such as I have never in my life experienced before, and there is nothing wrong in it."
"Don't you think so, too?" replied Levin.
"If they don't like it, it can't be helped. Besides, I think it's all right, eh?"
"I see that on the whole you are well satisfied with your day."
"Very well indeed."
"We finished the meadow, and I chummed up with such a fine old man. You can't imagine what a charming fellow he is.
Well, then, you are satisfied with your day, and so am I. First of all, I solved two chess problems. One, a very good one, beginning with a pawn move. I'll show it you. And afterwards, I thought over our yesterday's conversation. What about yesterday's conversation? Asked Levin, who had finished